70, market value credit, or limited market value extension. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, members, Senate File 370 is a bill I've introduced before, and what it does is it provides a moratorium on the phase-out of the limited market value legislation. There's a significant displacement that's taking place relative to this, and with the sudden acceleration of property tax rates with the phase-out, people in older homes, people with lakeshore property, some ag property, people with incomes that aren't positioned to absorb such a hit find themselves in great difficulty. And so I understand, I mean, having been here, obviously, when, although never serving on this committee, when this was initiated, I understand the direction we're going in, but the legislation is introduced because I think it would have a beneficial impact on people least able to afford this acceleration of property tax rates. There are several people who would like to testify briefly in support of this legislation. In particular, I have with me Mr. Matt Smith, and I think members of the committee know that Mr. Smith currently is the financial director for the City of St. Paul, but obviously in not too many years ago was the Commissioner of Revenue for the state of Minnesota. So obviously he has a dual perspective and can suggest why this legislation would be appropriate.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chairman and members, I've just provided a handout with a few bullet points and then a couple of maps that I just want to speak about briefly, just to illustrate what's been the situation in St. Paul in the last few years in terms of homeowner property taxes. What are some of the things, limited market value phase out among them, that have helped contribute to that problem? And in particular, what the future looks like in St. Paul as the remaining phase out of limited market value comes to an end, what particular impacts that's going to have. And I think that speaks to the motivation for this bill. Homeowner property taxes have increased particularly rapidly within St. Paul. The median home in St. Paul has seen about an 88% increase in its bottom line tax bill since 2002. That's particularly difficult for city officials, given that the city's total property tax levy during that time has only increased 12%. There are a lot of reasons, of course, very hard to explain to taxpayers for why their property tax bill has gone up so much faster than the revenue to their local government. But certainly one of those has been the steep increases in homeowners' taxable market values, and a contributor to that has been the phase-out of limited market value. In St. Paul in 2007, this year, 82% of the homesteads in St. Paul are still receiving some reduction in taxable value due to limited market value. That's a much larger percentage than you find in the rest of Ramsey County. And this year, 12% of the homesteads in St. Paul are actually in the second tier, meaning they've got more than 15% increase in taxable.
Mr. Smith, what percent was that was subject to the limiting?
82% of the homesteads are seeing some reduction in their taxable value. Now, I want to, in context, say that that doesn't necessarily mean that all 82% of those are having their bottom line tax bill decrease because of limited market value, because it's a very complicated animal. But 12% of the homesteads actually still have so much value to phase back in that they were in the second tier of the phase out. And I'll show you a map about where those homesteads are in just a moment. Because most of Ramsey County, a much higher percentage of the value in suburban Ramsey County is already phased out, the remaining phase out will shift taxes from the countywide levy back more rapidly onto homesteads within St. Paul. And in particular, all of those taxes are going to shift particularly heavily back onto those homesteads that have the most value remaining. If you turn to the second page of the handout, you'll see a map, which is a countywide map. And you can see at the bottom of the page the outline of St. Paul. And what you'll see is much darker green coloring within the city of St. Paul. And what that illustrates is the much higher share of residential properties this year that are still subject to LMV in the city versus suburban Ramsey County. And so that gives you a picture then of how that county levy is going to shift more rapidly or heavily toward us St. Paul homesteads in the remainder of the phase out. The second page shows the concentration of homesteads that are most subject to the remaining tax shift from the LMD phase out. And you can see that those tend to be concentrated in older, long-established neighborhoods that, to begin with, had the most affordable ownership housing in the city, probably the county, and also neighborhoods and homeowners that are already facing a lot of other challenges. And so, I think this map really illustrates where the brunt of the current phase-out schedule is likely to fall over the next couple of years. Extending the phase out is a way to moderate or provide for a soft landing, a somewhat softer landing, at least not to exacerbate some of the other tax pressures on these homesteads. It also may allow the residential real estate market to catch up a little bit with the phase out pattern. There are some other approaches, certainly, that you're deliberating on that could also deal with this, probably not, they're not mutually exclusive necessarily. And better access to the targeted homeowner property tax fund, the state budget policies that would use state aids and other measures to moderate overall levy increases would also be helpful to these homesteads.
Mr. Smith, what percentage in St. Paul is county school district and city? Do you have a feel for how that kind of average breaks out?
In terms of the levy?
Yes.
Roughly a quarter of the levy is a city levy, and the other two probably something like 35 county, maybe 40 school. And I'm just guessing.
I was just trying to get a feel for what percentage the county would be as an effect of as the shifting occurs. Well, Senator Cohen, aware of the issue here with the city of St. Paul, but you know, as a general policy, this limiting shifts taxes from fast in value properties to properties that are growing slower, and I'm not exactly sure what the committee thinks about that, but that's certainly going to be part of our deliberation. I am aware of the issue with the limiting. I think 43.8% of the value in the state that's limited is currently on ag land. So I am aware that this is an issue that we're going to have to deal with.
And Mr. Chairman, there are,
Senator Cohen,
to your point, there are a couple of other people who would like to testify who can offer a broader perspective. This is an issue that impacts not only St. Paul. Obviously, it as I indicated at the outset, it impacts comparable neighborhoods in Minneapolis, a number of other cities around the state, ag property, lakeshore property, and we do have a couple other people here to testify to offer that particular perspective.
Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's public information now, but the department has a new limited market value study out that kind of categorizes all the data, and I think it might be helpful, you know, if we don't have time in this division, maybe if we had the department kind of give us an overview of limited market value, their current report on it, before we make any decisions on this.
Yes, Senator Bach, perhaps we'll do that in the full committee. I don't think
sure.
We'll have time.
I think it would be good for the whole committee to hear about.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, I just want to emphasize, again, I know you've got other bills on the agenda. Would like to have the other people testify. I just want to reemphasize what Mr. Smith pointed out. If you have the ability to pass this legislation, understanding that this is a moratorium on what's been state policy, where the policy or this legislation would catch up to the policy is with the diminishment of the real estate values in this state. As Mr. Smith said, you would have a softer landing for those individuals. So it would not put an end to the direction of that policy, but it would allow for a grace period in the areas in the state most impacted. And I want to emphasize that because, in all honesty, when I've introduced this legislation in previous sessions, and I think this is maybe my third session that I've presented this, the situation with the residential property values had not been exacerbated to the extent that it is today. And so I think that would lend some comfort to a passage of this bill. But again, Mr. Chairman, there are a couple of other people who are available for testimony.
Yeah, Senator Cohen, let's have the other testifiers come forward. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
I know Mr. Carlos, Mr. Erdman are here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
Carlson.
My name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and thanks, Senator Cohen, for introducing this bill. The limited market value program has been one of the most difficult issues for the League of Cities to tackle over the years. And let me just say at the outset that when the program was first established, our position was in opposition to limited market value, that we ought to maintain the use of full and true market value as the basis for taxation. Part of the problem is that today we have a huge amount of value excluded from taxation, and the problem is getting from here to a phase-out of the limited market value program ultimately. What I've provided to you today is a graphic that really shows, and this, I apologize, has not been updated for the most recent Department of Revenue report, but this shows you the breakout of limited market value or excluded value by broad property class. And I want to draw your attention to the top line of that chart. It shows that in the diamonds, it shows the phase down in actual dollars of excluded value for residential homesteads. And as Senator Skoy indicated, you can see the growth in the squares of the value excluded that is classified as agricultural. If you extend that to 2007, based upon the most recent Department of Revenue report, the amount of value excluded that's classified as agriculture is nearly $14 billion now. The amount of homestead value has declined to less than $10 billion. And you'll see that in the report when you consider that in the full committee. But that illustrates the challenge we have here of trying to phase out of the limited market value program. We think Senator Cohen's bill would help to achieve a soft landing. Let me just say one more comment, that our actual policy, as is carefully worded, would request that you extend limited market value, but only for residential homestead property, and do it in such a way that we don't have a permanent exclusion of value, but we have as Senator Cohen indicated, a gentle landing for properties that do experience in the future a large one-time increase in their property values. With that, I would stand for questions.
Let's hear from Mr. Eidman first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Henry Erdman, representing the Minnesota Erdman. Seasonal Recreational Property Owners Coalition today. Supported Senator Cohen's proposal. When the proposal of LMV began, all indications that over the next few years the state would slowly recapture this tax base created. Beginning almost as soon as the phase out began, plunged in the real estate market. A number of sources. Here prices continue to climb, and at a rate faster than the phase out. There's a great gap between estimated market value and limited market value for many seasonal recreational properties today than there was for the phase out. Obviously, the legislature decided that the phase out of LMV over time, recognizing the poor policy is simply abolishing it, when people's tax bills double or in a single year. The phase out worked for most. There's a huge gap of seasonal recreations estimated and limited value continues. Senator Cohen's proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Erdman. Senator Artman.
Thank you, Chair, for any of you, including Senator Cohen. Why wouldn't the better answer be just not to phase it out? I mean, why are we going to phase out limited market value if it's working as a safety valve to make sure that property taxes either way in any community don't go up and vary too much from one year to the next? It hurts people whose property taxes are diminishing. It also hurts people whose market values are increasing. So why isn't the better answer just to end the phase out and change the policy?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, this legislation doesn't end the policy. I will have to reemphasize, we've used the phrase up here of soft landing. It makes a significant difference to people who are least able to pay, who find themselves in situations where there's been a greater variance of property taxes, and provides the ability for those homeowners to have a greater ability to adjust to what's happening with the market and what's happening with property taxes. I will emphasize that this year in particular, as opposed to when I presented this bill a couple of years ago to this division, this year makes the point that with the diminishment of property valuations and with that change in the market, you know, beyond the control of this building, this will provide the soft landing for those people. And it seems to me we have a lot of discussion about property taxes around here and the impact on taxpayers. We can also take a look at what happens with legislation we pass that goes the other direction, that very explicitly will raise property taxes. And we're talking about putting a significant amount of general fund dollars into various forms of property tax relief this year. You know, this committee will consider LGA, will consider other kinds of tax aids and credits. This is something quite simple that will have that same impact, and will do so in a way that will dovetail now with the private market.
Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair, I don't disagree that we should have that soft landing and a transition if we're going to phase out limited market value. My question to you is, why are we going to continue with the phase out if we think that this is causing problems for property taxpayers and homeowners? Should we also be considering not doing the phase out at all?
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Artman, I guess I was attempting to present a bill that I thought was a limited answer to limited market value. If this committee would choose to use my bill as a vehicle to repeal the existing law, I'm not going to stop you. In a figurative sense, since I don't serve on the committee, but I would support that. But what I hear from people with a greater degree of tax expertise than I have, as I often say when I'm in front of this committee, my responsibility is only to spend the money, not raise it. people with again the tax expertise suggest that public policy would suggest we should continue in that direction. If this committee, in studying the issue, feels that we've taken a wrong policy direction, I'm not going to disagree.
Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate File 370? Mr. Hesse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I will try to be brief as well. The Minnesota Chamber opposes extending the phase out of limited market value. In 2001, the property tax reform legislation established a six-year phase out of limited market value. It's already been extended by 2 years, and we think it should be implemented now on the delayed schedule and not delayed any further. Really, our rationale has been talked about, or why we oppose this legislation, is that it really just shifts property tax burden from protected properties to unprotected ones, but also, as the chair points out, it shifts property tax burden from faster-growing properties properties with faster-growing valuations to those with slower-growing valuations. And in the Department of Revenue's last limited market value study, they estimated that about 78% of Minnesota homes actually had paid more property tax because of limited market value than they would have otherwise. So this doesn't work for the unprotected properties like businesses and utilities and others. Apartments, and it also doesn't work for the majority of homes in this state. They end up paying more. So for those reasons, we oppose extending the phase out. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hesse. Questions, members? Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Hesse, then, do you think that the phase out is a good policy?
Mr. Hesse.
Mr. Chair and Senator Artman, yes, we think the phase out should continue and limited market value should end for taxes payable, I think it's now 2010. So we do not believe that we should have a limited market value law in the state.
Sure.
Senator Artman.
Mr. Hesse, then, do you also believe that if a property increases in value by 20% in terms of the assessment, that a homeowner or business property owner's taxes are appropriately raised by 20% in 1 year?
Mr. Hesse.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, just because a property's value increases does not mean its tax has to go up by a comparable amount. If the tax base in a jurisdiction increases by 20% all total, the only way that all properties would go up by that 20% is if spending also increased by similar amounts. I think you're getting at a individual property when they increase by maybe an amount higher relative to many other properties in the jurisdiction. And for commercial industrial properties, we have never supported adding or including commercial industrial under limited market value type law because we think it distorts who pays the tax and ends up shifting a lot of burden. And so we have taken positions consistently over the years not to include commercial industrial to allow them to really make commercial industrial property and hopefully others pay the property tax based on their true market value.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, so Mr. Hesse, what you're saying is that if we have the limited market value on residential property, that shifts a burden to the commercial industrial properties if we have a protection for the residential homeowners, because then because the commercial property owners don't fit into the limited market value protection, the burden shifts, and you would oppose that shift.
Mr. Hesse.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, correct. Limited market value does shift from protected properties like homes to unprotected ones like commercial industrial.
Thank you.
Members, I would draw your attention to the fiscal note that is with this. We'll certainly have to keep that in mind as we move forward with this. Are there any other questions? Anyone else to testify? Thank you, Mr. Hesse.
Thank you.
My name is Todd Liljenquist, and I'm with Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. My comments will be very brief as well. Testifying in opposition to this bill, and I just have a couple of reasons that I would like to state. First, limited market value has the effect of shifting property taxes onto other properties, as has already been stated. Representing the multi-housing industry, we're obviously concerned with shifting property taxes onto apartments. And according to the 2005 figures, not the most recent figures that Senator Bach had mentioned, but the Department of Revenue found that statewide apartments pay 7.9% more with limited market value than they would without that in effect. And in the metro area, it's 8.6% more. And it's not just apartments that pay more. Statewide, 68% of residential homesteads pay more, while only 32% actually pay less. For example, in the city of Woodbury, it's a 50-50 split. 50% are helped, 50% are hurt by it. Second, limited market value has a potential of being misleading to taxpayers. Some taxpayers assume they're being helped by limited market value, and in fact, they are not. According to these Department of Revenue figures, almost 20% of homeowners who actually receive some limited market value actually pay more than they would if the law was not in effect. A homeowner in this situation would likely look at their property tax statement and say, well, imagine what my taxes would be without limited market value. But the net result is that some taxpayers are completely unaware that they're paying more. Finally, now is a good time to let limited market value phase out. Home values are stabilizing, while apartment values and commercial and industrial values are expected to rise, which means that they'll be picking up more of the property tax base. Also, there's no need to delay phasing out limited market value. Property owners have ample notice that it's phasing out. Under the current schedule, all property will be valued at its estimated full market value for property tax purposes for taxes payable in 2010.
Thank you. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Liljenquist, good to see you in the committee. Question for you. Are properties that are rentals, do they qualify for limited market value?
Senator Ortman, no, they do not.
Okay. So Senator Ortman. In similarly to the commercial industrial, your position would be that we are protecting residential homeowners at the expense of the rental property owners.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, that's correct.
And Mr. Chair, could you elaborate just a little bit about what you were saying about the property owners that whose property do not, we're talking about the residential property owners now, the folks that have properties that are increasing in value at the top, like the 15% or the 20%, you're saying we're protecting those at the expense of the people with the properties that are increasing at a lesser value. Is that what you're getting at?
Right, right. That increase, the increase in property tax that they are not paying is shifted onto all other properties, those that don't qualify for the limited market value, like commercial and industrial or apartments or other properties, as well as those homestead properties that didn't have a increase to qualify for the limited market value.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a question.
Senator Orman.
I'm wondering if that limited market value study that Senator Bach was referring to might quantify for us what that shift is for the residential property owners. It'll be interesting to find out what that report says.
Yes, Senator Orman, I think Senator Bach will have that report in the full committee.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. May, I see you headed this way.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm a member of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers Legislative Committee. In regard to limited market value, I can tell you that MAO's position has been the same, and I don't want to age myself, but in 1978, 1979, when we had limited market value before, it's been the same since 93, since limited market value came back into existence up till today. That we certainly oppose limitations to a market value because it skews the taxation. Our position statement for 2007 reads that MAO supports a principle of ad valorem taxation. MAO believes adjustments to market values, such as limitation on assessors' estimated market values, acquisition values, or deferments or exemption, creates inequities between taxpayers. We also believe we encourage the continued use of state-administered programs such as property tax refund programs, special targeting refunds, the income tax system, et cetera, if policymakers wish to grant additional tax relief to certain taxpayers. So we would be opposed to extension, and we feel it's time to return to a market value system. I would like to clarify one question that was asked on rental property. Certain rental property does qualify for limited market value. It's only those rental properties that are 4 units or above that are classified as apartment that do not. Duplexes or triplexes would qualify even though they are non-homestead.
Thank you, Mr. May. Questions? Senator Cohen, any closing?
Well, Mr. Chairman, obviously you've had the chance to have a full exposition of this issue. I find it striking that I think all the witnesses, both pro and con, agree that you have a change in market valuations. You do have a change. Obviously, this legislation would have an impact for a limited period of time on other property classifications. I appreciate Mr. May's distinction within rental units because it makes the case, again, that we do have this legislation having a significant impact on a wide swath of people in the state of Minnesota. And it's not to suggest that this division doesn't have some responsibility to look at the various property classifications. And I've my first term in the Senate, I was on this division a number of years ago and spent some time when there was discussion about what to do with, at that time in particular, rental property. And certainly you've got some wide variations with CI property in the state. But it doesn't negate what's happening with the residential homeowners who are least able to afford these increases in property taxes in areas of the state, not just simply St. Paul and Minneapolis, that have had a significant impact. And that's why this legislation is drafted in a limited way to deal with a problem that now we hope will be of limited duration, at least for the foreseeable future, as you, again, have that diminishment in property values. 10 years from now, there will not be the impact that will take place today. And I think this division and the full committee could take a step forward in providing, again, I'll emphasize that soft landing.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Without objection, we will lay Senate File 370 over for possible inclusion in the property tax division bill. certainly I think we need to keep this alive until we hear from the department on their report. Thank you, Senator.
Chairman, members, thank you.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to present to this committee Senate File 824, which is a couple of minor modifications to the current 4D laws. The low-income rental classification was reestablished in 2005 in response to unprecedented increases in property valuations and resulting tax increases of between 50% to 125% after the Tax Reform Act of 2001. The rent-restricted properties were the only properties that had a class rate increase in 2001 from 1% to 1.25%. The class rate was established in response to the inability to define an appropriate valuation methodology that recognizes mortgage and deed restrictions on specific properties. At that time, when we reestablished the 4D classification, we established an eligibility threshold of 75%, which was a negotiated number as class rate is prorated to qualifying units. Since that time, the MHFA reported that over 50% of application denials were attributable to projects not meeting the 75% threshold requirement, with a great majority being greater Minnesota properties. Today, Mr. Chair, members, we are proposing two changes to the low-income rent classification eligibility criteria. These changes are recommended and supported in the Department of Revenue study in 4D, and the department is here today, and they'll speak to this, but I think that they don't object too highly to these changes. The first change is to remove the provision requiring that at least 75% of the units be affordable in order for a rental property to be eligible. And that change moves it from 75% to 20%. The second change allows local government-funded projects to be eligible for the reduced tax class rate. Under current law, I believe only federal and state-funded programs were eligible. Mr. Chair, members, approximately 430 properties with approximately 10,000 units of housing have been excluded from participating in this program. And unfortunately, 351 of these properties are in Greater Minnesota. The Greater Minnesota projects tend to have lower percentage of affordable housing units as part of their mixed income developments. And a 20% minimum requirement would cover the great majority of publicly funded projects across the state, allowing a significant number of units to benefit from this classification. And as to the local government funding, many locally financed housing developments contain the same rent restrictions as properties financed by federal and state programs, and they should also they should not be excluded from participating in the program. Mr. Chair, well, and no more members, but Mr. Chair, Anne Marie McIntyre is an asset manager for Project for Pride and Living, and she would like to testify on the bill.
Thank you, Senator Mua, and Mr. Chairman. We are happy that this language is being addressed.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Anne Marie McIntyre, and I work for Project for Pride and Living as the asset manager. And I oversee all the ownership and properties, of which we have 140 buildings and about 780 units of rental properties. On the yellow sheet, I have outlined the properties that did not qualify because we have our rent restrictions written at the city level with MCDA, now CPED. And those rent restrictions are the same as MHFA rent restrictions and follow compliance and are inspected and meet all the other eligibilities except that it's at the local unit of government level. And there were two properties that have Section 8 but not 75% of the units, and so they were disqualified. And since it's prorated, only the units that have these restrictions are eligible for the class rates. It didn't seem worth it to have that language in there since they're prorated. So we just want to say that with the new rent classification, We have seen in just 1 year's time an ability now to maintain the buildings better because we're able to put away a little money for deferred maintenance. Once we pay property taxes, we pay ourselves our property management fee. But what happened was we were not able to pay property management fees for about 3 years and just covered the utilities, covered the expenses, and did maintenance on the buildings. So this will help make up a little bit of that and also to put a little bit of money in reserves for these properties are in not a high-rent district. These are troubled properties, and we will hope in the coming years to get low-income housing tax credits. But those applications are only approved at about one or two projects a year, so it'll be many years before these can see significant capital improvements with new funding. So this... this bill would help to change the language, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McIntyre.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Maureen Warren, and I work for the Wilder Foundation. I'm the Director of Supportive Housing and Employment Services at Wilder. Wilder is a private foundation that is an operating foundation, which means we don't give money to others. It means we provide the social services ourselves. And we do school success programs, we do mental health, we do services for troubled children, services for the elderly, and we have a significant portion of our work that is providing supportive housing. And under the Amherst Wilder was a very generous person who passed away 100 years ago and used his will to establish the foundation. So we've been continuously operating for 100 years, and under the terms of the will, we can work in the East Metro area. So we do most of our work in St. Paul, but we can work in Ramsey County, Dakota County, Washington County, and Anoka County. And we own or manage for others 1,600 units of supported housing. And by supported housing, I mean that these are units for very low-income people, that the average income across all of our units for any of our tenants is $7,000 a year. And generally, they are folks that are either on SSI, some form of other form of disability payment, or they are seniors on fixed incomes. And I want to thank the members that made the change in 2005. In the group of properties I manage, some of them do meet the 75% requirement. Some of them do not. I wanted to give you just an illustration of one that we manage for others. We manage a property that's right off of 94. Some of you may be familiar with. It's called Redeemer's Arms. It's right off of Dale Street in 94. It was built by the oldest Lutheran church in Minnesota, Redeemer's Lutheran Church, which is still an operating Lutheran church. And they asked Wilder to begin managing their property about 14, 15 years ago as they were losing parishioners in size. And the property was originally built with HUD funding, and it has 150 units. They're efficiency apartments that are serving folks with disabilities, either mental illness or chemical dependency, and seniors also. It began as a senior, primarily a senior building when it was constructed, but like many senior affordable housing sites, they are now eligible to take folks that meet disability requirements, and so the census has changed quite a bit. And Redeemer's Arms is serving very many people that were previously homeless. It is a frequent visiting place for the folks that are working on the state's commitment to long-term homelessness. We're often seeking service dollars and innovative methods, and we like to think it's a place that is providing a great set of services for folks that were formerly homeless. The impact of having only 82 out of the 150 units are HUD-subsidized and meet the definition. And the reason I wanted to highlight that is to give you just a little bit of history as to why there's this variation in the number of units. And I don't have a real clear explanation other than that HUD works like all of us work when we have limited resources. And as entities like Redeemer's Arms, when they applied and sought to build this unit, they applied for a project, and they took what they got in terms of the form of subsidy. And so there is a commitment on the most affordable housing providers work as if it's a seven-layer cake, and they take the public subsidy, whatever private dollars they can leverage, sometimes a state or local government, often a state or local government comes in to help them Sometimes you have private industry, sometimes you have volunteers, but these projects get done with at least seven layers. I may be even outdated in my characterization. And so there, you do have these situations where the subsidy dollars are pieced together in order to make the project workable and keep it affordable. For Redeemer's Arms, the impact of not being eligible is from 2004 to 2005. The property tax bill went from $86,000 to $127,000, or a 46.6% increase. We saw a further increase in 2005 for $136,968. And there's property couldn't carry the increases. There were not sufficient reserves. The church has no resources. Wilder Foundation paid the property tax bill because we pay our bills in a timely fashion. And the way this manifests itself is I have a AP Wilder entry on the property where they owe me the balance of the property tax bill, and I have no realistic expectation that the property can ever generate the opportunity to pay me back, and I will probably write it off when my accountants tell me I can no longer carry it. And you know, Wilder Foundation has the resources to do that, but many of the other operators do not, and I'm working there for management fees, not to pay bills for them that they have no expectation of paying back. I brought some information, if anyone's interested, that profiles the properties we have and the unit count.
Thank you, Ms. Warren. Questions, members? Senator Waugh, did you say the department was wanting to say something on this bill?
I don't know if they actually want to say something, but I did speak with them, and they're okay. And, Mr. Chair, I just want to draw the members' attention to the fiscal note. The impact is pretty minimal. I don't know if the department was okay with that, unless you want to hear from them.
Well, Senator Moore, correct me if I'm wrong, but when we were going through the department technical policy bill, they had a similar provision to this included in that bill until they saw the fiscal note, and then they withdrew that. But they did have the percent at 25 instead of 20, I believe. You want to talk a little bit about that?
And, Mr. Chair, the department certainly could speak to that. I spoke with them, and they indicated to me that the difference of 20 and 25% is negligible. And I believe that the reason why they took it out was initially they thought there was not going to be any fiscal impact. And when they saw that there was some monetary impact, I think in the larger picture of the governor's budget proposal, all the little pieces add up to be something, and they took that out. So, but the department certainly could speak for themselves.
Mr. Manson, did you have something?
Mr. Chair and committee members, Jack Manson with the Department of Revenue. And the proposal that was in our department bill decreased this percentage from 75 down to 25. This takes it a little bit further. And we are supportive of going to the 20%. That's just the percentage of whether the building qualifies or not. Our real concern is that it only applies to those units that are subsidized, and that's unchanged in our bill or Senator's bill. So we'd be fine with this.
Thank you, Mr. Manson. Questions, members? Senator Moore? Anyone else that wants to testify on Senate File 824? Senator Moore?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to move that if it's possible or when the time is appropriate that Senate File 824 be recommended for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Without objection, we will lay Senate File 824 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you, Senator
Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Ortman. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for hearing my bill today. And Senator Skoy, I personally am very grateful for your signing the bill for purposes of discussion, and I appreciate that's the purpose of your signature and authorship of the bill. Members, we have to do something to address the problem that seniors face when they own a home in Minnesota. they can be vulnerable to our property tax system and pay a particularly high price when we raise our property taxes, especially if they are 65 or older and have been living in their home for 25 years or more. That's what this bill addresses. What this bill does is it sets a cap on property taxes at year 25 for those vulnerable seniors, so they don't have to face the choice of staying in their home or paying for their prescription drugs. What the bill does is it creates a cap for seniors who have lived in their home 25 years, are 65 and older, and have an income issue. They have to, there's a qualifier, a condition. If you earn more than $60,000 in the year, you do not qualify for the cap. So there is an income adjustment here. We hear so often, and I did as a county commissioner, from seniors who can't face the increases in the property taxes and they want to stay in their home. And I think we need to find a way to allow them to stay in their home. In this way, they still pay the property taxes in their community. They just don't pay the increase. So it's a very small amount. These folks have lived in their homes for 25 years, and that means that they've paid for the investments in the infrastructure in the community for 25 years. They built the schools. They built the community centers. They built the government centers, the roads. They paid the assessments in their communities for the school districts, the counties, and the cities for 25 years. And they still should continue to pay because they still will receive services, members, in the community. But they shouldn't face the increases every year. And so that's what this does. We're talking about a very small number of people that live in their homes. We don't want them to have to choose. We want them to be able to retire in the community that they built. And sometimes if we don't have the affordable housing and the senior housing in our communities, they have no choice but not only to leave their home, but to leave their community. And this bill is an attempt to create a safety valve. Now, what I did is I took the standards that we have for our deferral program. We've talked about this in this committee before, Mr. Chair, a deferral program where seniors can defer their property tax payments, and the state provides a revolving loan fund that pays off their property taxes, and then the bill accrues at the end, and when they sell their home, then they offset and pay out the property taxes that they deferred. We don't have very many seniors that participate in that program, number one, because they don't know about it, and number two, probably because they don't want to take the equity out of their home. They want to leave it for folks that follow, their children or grandchildren or whomever. So they aren't participating, and part of that might be the notice issue, and in this bill would make both more visible, both programs. We would have the property tax cap, and we would also make sure that that deferral program were more visible because we would be providing notices through our county auditors. Let me just say that there is a fiscal note on this bill. If you look at it, there's actually a savings, and that's because the state of Minnesota will not have to refund and rebate to the seniors that qualify for this program. So over time, we actually save money. We also will have, I'm sure, an impact at the local communities. Let's be realistic. The counties and the cities and the school districts will have to shift a little bit of the burden to other people in the community in order to do this. The administrative work of that is not that difficult, and I have an email from the county administrator in Carver County that I will share with the members of this committee, who says this is an administrative question. It's something that easily can be done. They have the ability to adjust the levy for everybody else. We'll pass that out right now, Mr. Chair, and we'll give it to a page, if you would. Okay. And so we can make these adjustments, and I would argue that the shift makes sense. Now, we don't normally like shifts in property taxes, but we have all kinds of them in our property tax system right now. This one is good for a particular reason in my mind, which is these folks have paid the property taxes, they built the community, and now there are more people that need more services, and we should ask those people who now bring new kids to the school district and now need the community center and now are basically generating the need for bigger government centers and things like that, they can and should pay the increases due to those changes in the community. People have paid, they built the community, and we should recognize that they've done that, and we should value them and give them every opportunity we can to stay in their home and retire in the community that they built. Mr. Chair, I'd be willing to answer any questions. There are a couple of testifiers here today, and I'm very happy to have some support for this bill.
Senator Ormond, let's hear from the testifiers first.
Mr. Chair, my name's Mike Downing from White Bear Lake. committee members. I am a member of the Tax Committee of the Minnesota Senior Federation. And we would like to compliment the Senator on this bill. And you're hearing many bills to address seniors and other people to address the rapidly rising property tax burden that all of us are experiencing. Many of us are living on fixed incomes, and the percent of our income that is paid in property taxes is increasing and increasing. This bill is trying to address that, to keep people in their homes for as long as possible. Part of the American dream is home ownership, and we want to pay our property taxes, but we want to be able to stay in our homes for as long as possible. We thank the Senator for bringing this forward. We believe that you'll be hearing other ones, and I'll be testifying to the next bill as well.
Thank you, Mr. Downing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bethany Chernholm, and I'm a city councilwoman from Chanhassen. Our city motto in Chanhassen is Chanhassen, a community for life, and I'm very proud of that motto. And we have many opportunities in our city, and we are growing, we're expanding. We have Highway 212 coming through, which is going to provide economic benefit for our city as, and also providing jobs for our citizens. We have a new high school coming in, and so our children will be guaranteed a quality education in our town, and we have many opportunities for young families in our city. And one of the biggest populations, not biggest, but one of the strongest growing parts of our city is our senior citizens. On any given day, if you go to our senior center, it is overflowing with people playing bingo, taking classes on protecting their computers from viruses, lectures on traveling to China. It's a very vibrant part of our community. And as a council member, I'm constantly struggling with how to provide affordable housing to our citizens. And I find this bill to be perhaps one part of a way that I can implement that into our town. Our senior population is roughly 12%. And of that 12%, roughly 400, these are just numbers I got yesterday, 400 of them are homeowners. And so I find this to be a way that we could take some relief or give them some relief from property taxes and allow them to stay in our homes and remain vital in our community.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Chernholm. Senator Armand, we certainly do have it on our agenda to do something about property taxes, and particularly with people with more modest incomes. One of the policy issues that we've always kind of struggled with, and this has happened on lake shores, for example, where you have a seasonal rec facility and then a homestead right next to each other, and you get different property taxes on virtually identical properties. And that would occur under this scenario if you had two homes in the same street that were very similar, and one had been lived in for 25 years and one was a young family that had just moved into the community and had kids and was starting out. They would have different property tax bills on very similar properties, and that is a policy issue that as we work through this this next week putting our bill together, we're going to have to work through. But we certainly are sympathetic to the issue. Questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Senator Ortman. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it is good to have this discussion. I'm just curious about the 25-year requirement. It would seem that as people age, sometimes they move closer to live near their children, or perhaps they move into a one-level home, something that's easier to maintain. So I'm curious as to what your thinking is behind including that 25-year requirement to live in the same home to be eligible for this.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and thank you for the question, Senator Sieben. I know there are others that have the same question. I know the Senior Federation would like to see some adjustments to the bill for that very reason. And there are others as well that are concerned because people do change hands with their property. But for me, the philosophy behind it was these folks we know have invested in the community because they've been there 25 years. And so if you choose the community, knowing what the property taxes are, knowing about the risks of increasing property taxes, you're making that choice. But these folks that have been in their homes, they're not really making a choice to move into the community. They're already there, and they've already paid those property taxes and for those facilities and those services for 25 years. We do have a very mobile community, and I don't want to hurt people that are making those choices to downsize or anything like that. This is definitely a work in progress, Senator, and so if you have some ideas about how we could address that mobility issue and some of those wise choices that seniors are making to downsize, I welcome your input. This is, as I said, a work in progress. My thinking was, however, we knew that these people have been in that community for 25 years. We know that they've paid the property taxes. We know they faced those increases for 25 years, and we know that they've built it, and we want to recognize their contribution.
And Senator Ortman, did I hear you say that these are the same criteria that as we have for the deferral program?
Mr. Chair, the same criteria in terms of income and age requirements.
Thank you. Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ortman and Councilmember Chernholm. In fact, I know that I'm pretty sure former Representative Chris Chernholm, who represented part of my district in the Minnesota House of Representatives in the late 80s, so I know he's in the room here somewhere. And it's good to see you. The question that I have, and is there anything in your bill, is the concern that I've had about proposals like this, is because of the shift that occurs within the community, is there anything in here that protects if you have a circumstance where you have someone who, while at this point in their retirement life, does not have a high level of taxable income, however, they may have considerable wealth. And the concern that I have is that part of the population, senior population in Minnesota, that may have some considerable wealth. On the other hand, we're capping a tax, and yet we may be shifting that tax onto some folks in our community that may be at the most difficult time of their life to pay property taxes as they're raising a family and they're trying to pay their mortgage. And so is there anything in here that addresses that?
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Larson, it's a very good question. You know, you might have a homeowner with a $5 million home, and do we want to cap that person's property taxes? Again, as I told Senator Steben, this is a work in progress. It's a start. We have so many different competing interests. Where do you start to come up with the comprehensive solution? I just thought, well, let's just start somewhere with the issue that we've got these seniors in these homes with these concerns. Again, I go back to the philosophy that says this is a 25-year resident. So that resident has been paying property taxes for that $5 million property for 25 years and will continue to pay property taxes in that community. It's just the increase that will be the cap. And that's really important because that person has paid for 25 years, faced all the increases, paid for them all, but now we're just going to put a safety valve on it and say no more increases. And I think the number is manageable here because we're talking about, as Councilwoman Chernholm said, a very small number. Once you start working through the qualifications of this program, we're talking about a very small number. If there are 12% of the residents in the city of Chanhassen seniors, a small amount of them live in a home. An even smaller amount have lived in their home for 25 years. We're reducing the number of participants with each of these qualifications, and then you've got the qualification of the income as well. So we just keep whittling down to the number of the people that qualify by recognizing that first that they've contributed and then go back down the system. But I think the answer here is they continue to pay for services. They've been paying all the increases for 25 years, and now we're just going to cap the increase. Mr. Chair, if I could just comment, I should have also said that we do recognize that if they're earning income, and if you've got a $5 million home, you're very likely to have investments and to have income off of those investments. And so I think that $60,000 income level is significant. And if you would suggest a change to that, Senator Larson, I would be open to that, or some other way of identifying the people that we want to protect here, I am very open to the concept.
And Senator Ortman, if you know, as we move forward and look at this, perhaps we could look at some moderation of the cliff or something too. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate File 681? Mr. May.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom May with the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Looking at the bill, the concern we would have is the complexity of tracking the information, especially in Subdivision 2, where it talks about changes in square footage, value of improvements exceeding 15% of the estimated market value, and so forth. It doesn't say who's responsible for tracking that information, but I assume it would be the assessors doing that, and it would add some complexity to this bill of doing that ongoing year after year as if they qualified for the program. So I guess in that regard, it seems like we don't disagree with the concept at all, but certainly there probably would be a less complex way to accomplish that, we would hope.
Well, Mr. May, I think we've heard that it would be a relatively small number in some jurisdictions. It might be quite a bit higher percentage of utilization in some of the rural communities where the where there's tend to stay longer and the incomes are lower, but we certainly take that into consideration. Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, if I could, I'm not sure exactly what the complication is with the assessors, but I'm willing to work with them and find out what it is and see if there's some way to address it in this bill. It brings me to one more point that I'd like to make about this bill. One of the good things about this bill is that everyone can anticipate what's going to happen, especially the auditors and the assessors. They get 25 years' notice. Our county auditors know when a property changes hands. They also know when a property does not change hands. And so they've got 25 years' notice. They're going to know who's going to fall off the 25-year path towards this protection as they do their work. And every year when they go back and assess, or every year that they send out their property tax notice, they're going to know whether someone else has fallen off the ability to qualify for this program. So there are no surprises. And I don't know about you, but I think the worst thing that happens to our counties and in the tax system are the surprises. And so this 25-year notice period actually puts everybody on notice that we've got a homeowner that's proceeding towards this protection, and we need to plan for it.
Thank you, Mr. May. Seeing no one else and without objection, thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Ortman. I will continue to look at ways to address this issue as we wrap up this property tax article. With no objection, we'll lay Senate file number 681 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Sieben, are you... And we're kind of jumping around a little bit here, but that's okay. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 1255 is a pretty simple bill. It just allows for a property that is used to operate a state or federally approved apprenticeship program is exempt from property taxes. And with me today to testify on the need for this bill is Bill Straczynski and John Quanstrom.
Did
I pronounce your name?
Yes.
Mr. Straczynski.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I wholeheartedly endorse this initiative, and I turn the mic over to Mr. Quanstrom to talk about the details.
Mr. Quanstrom.
Thank you. My name is John Quanstrom. I am Director of Labor Relations and General Counsel for SMARCA, which is the Sheet Metal, Air Conditioning, and Roofing Contractors Association. We are a trade association. We represent contractors, about 350 of them across the state of Minnesota. They're involved in sheet metal, HVAC, and roofing construction. Our contractors employ approximately 3,500 construction workers. I am personally involved in, as an employer representative, in 8 different apprenticeship programs across the region. The largest program which I am involved with is the Metro Area Sheet Metal Program. We currently have approximately 325 apprentices in our school. That's down. When the construction economy was booming, we had 500 apprentices. Currently, we're at about 325. The Metro Area Sheet Metal Joint Apprenticeship and Training Committee owns a school building in White Bear Lake. It's actually a former elementary school that was purchased from White Bear Lake Public Schools in 1998. And for the first 7 years of taxation, we enjoyed property tax-exempt status under Chapter 272. We were recognized as a school. It's my understanding that Ramsey County, the former tax assessor, retired and a new one was appointed. The new tax assessor decided that he didn't believe we qualified as a school, rejected the application for exemption, and sent us a property tax bill. So the first time that we were required to pay property taxes was for taxes payable in 2006. As we then researched this issue of whether or not we are a school, we found that apprenticeship programs meet that definition. Some do, some don't, and it really depended upon what county you were in. Some counties were favorable to it, others were not. Ramsey County tended to recognize apprenticeship schools as indeed schools. Hennepin County traditionally did not. And as you go across the state, that varied. We are here today to support this bill to recognize our program as a school. We believe that we are a school. We believe that it's a great investment for the legislature to recognize us as such, and it's just good public policy. In the metro area here, our apprentices, the first stage apprentice, so the young, or not necessarily young, but the man or woman coming into our program at the first level, they earn a total wage package of $29.31 an hour. The taxable base wage is $18.03. Apprentices that have come from a tech school background, they go to an additional 3 years of school in White Bear Lake. Those that have not completed a tech school program, St. Paul College, Hennepin Tech, someplace like that, they would go to 5 years of our school. And classes are held during the day. They go roughly 2 days a week. They have 200 hours of instruction per year. We have full-time instructors. We really do operate as a school. The apprentices, as they move through, assuming they go to school, they get their education, and they don't have problems, they advance to become journeymen. The journeyman sheet metal worker in the metro area, current wages are $50.13 is the hourly total package. The taxable base is $34.68. We believe that these people that we are turning out to be journeymen sheet metal construction workers are productive citizens, they're taxpaying, they are the type of people that drive the economy in Minnesota. We believe that their wage package, their benefits, compares very favorably with college graduates, people that go through the Minscu system. If you set the property tax issue aside, the public subsidy or the public support for apprenticeship programs right now, really, by the state of Minnesota, is just through the Department of Labor and Industry, where they supervise the program. And I've had conversations with those people over the years. It appears that the state investment for apprenticeship programs is about $30 per apprentice. And we believe that extending the property tax exemption to make it clear that our schools are schools within the meaning of the statute just makes sense for the state of Minnesota. We're turning out people that are making as much money as college graduates. They're productive citizens. They've got family health care. They've got quality pensions. And the investment by the state of Minnesota would be very minimal. It's $30 a person now. And we just want to clarify that the property tax exemption should continue. We believe that is good public policy. It is the fair thing to do, and it's a great return on the dollar compared to Minscu. Not that we're suggesting that's not a good investment as well. We just think in the interest of fairness and public policy, it makes a lot of sense to support this initiative. On behalf of our contractors, and the apprentices that that are in our program, we urge you to support this bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Kornstrom.
Correct.
For your work in preparing men and women to earn a livable wage. We certainly appreciate that. I just want to clarify a little bit. This really wouldn't change the state subsidy, because if you're exempt from the property tax, it would be picked up by the other parcels in the jurisdiction, not the state. But we are sympathetic to your plight. Mr. Straczynski, did you have anything to more further to say?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks for that. Anyone else who wants to testify on Senate File 1255? Questions? Thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Sieben. I think this is a very good provision that we're going to take a good hard look at doing. So with that, without objection, we'll lay Senate File 1255 over for inclusion, possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you. Senator Larson, Bloomington fiscal disparities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to present Senate File 811 to the Property Tax Division. Senate File 811 very simply would strike from law the requirement for Bloomington taxpayers to refund or pay back the interest on a loan that was taken out to help the state make its improvements to largely to Highway 77 and the 494 interchange when the Mall of America was originally developed. And if you really to understand the reason for my bringing the bill before today, you have to go back to the original development of the Mall of America and the deal. There was really two major provisions that were passed to help the taxpayers of Bloomington provide the subsidy to build the infrastructure to assist the development of the Mall of America. One of them was a $108 million tax increment financing provision that helped pay for infrastructure around the Mall of America. The other was to move up the improvements that were already scheduled for Highway 77. And in fact, when MnDOT was prepared and ready to make the improvements to Highway 77, local leaders delayed because we weren't sure. And when I say we, I wasn't there at the time. But as I look back through history, prudently so, there was a delay because we were unclear, or leaders were unclear, how the Mall of America property would develop, or the stadium site would develop, if you will. And ultimately, the Cedar Bridge was done, but other than doing the 494 Cedar Avenue part of the road, wasn't prudent, not knowing what development would occur. So essentially, that road did not develop at the time that it would have otherwise been improved. And then once the deal was in place and development was ready to move forward, as we know how things work with MnDOT, that project fell a little bit further down the list, but was still on the improvement plan. And so what was necessary to get the deal started was to loan money to MnDOT to make the improvements in a timely fashion. And that that loan was made from the fiscal disparities pool, which essentially charged CI properties throughout the metropolitan area that pay into the fiscal disparities pool an additional amount to cover the highway improvement and the interest. Now, quickly thereafter, and I don't have exactly the year, MnDOT paid back the principal on that loan. But what remained is the agreement that Bloomington taxpayers would pay the interest on the bonds that were sold to advance that project. Now, some will say a deal was a deal, and now it's time to pay it back, and you're here to say you don't want to pay it back. The one thing that I think that we have the benefit here today of is hindsight. And I'm not here at all to criticize what deal was made in the late 80s as it related to developing the Mall of America. I think many would agree that the Mall of America, especially from a state perspective, has been a huge success. The amount of money that it generates in terms of sales tax revenue is a very successful story for the state of Minnesota. However, now that we have the ability to look back and see that the deal was made to have Bloomington taxpayers pay back that interest, and when you look at the fact that Bloomington taxpayers really haven't yet to receive benefit from the Mall of America in terms of receiving property taxes, I think it allows us to look back and say this facility was enough of a success and actually paid enough into the fiscal disparities pool from the day of development moving forward that it far justifies perhaps all the communities that have benefited from the development of the mall forgiving the interest on these bonds. Actually, but for the development of the Mall of America, the communities that actually receive fiscal disparities dollars, I think you can persuasively argue, would receive less today had the mall never been developed. And so it's with that that I'm here to say that we can now look back on this deal differently than perhaps we were able to when the mall was developed, and say that we really shouldn't levy Bloomington taxpayers shouldn't have to pay back. This is an amount that ultimately will have to be levied, $5 million starting in 2015 for 10 years. And so, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer questions. But the essential message is in my presentation is that the state has been a big beneficiary of the Mall of America. The fiscal disparities pool has been a beneficiary of the development of the Mall of America. But the folks who have been the slowest to receive benefit from the Mall of America have been the taxpayers of Bloomington, and yet we're on the hook for the $48.8 million repayment. And if you factor that in and add up the other investments that Bloomington taxpayers have either paid or on the hook to pay for as it relates to the public subsidy of the Mall of America, it seems reasonable to me that eliminating this obligation for repayment is good public policy. Thank you.
Senator Larson, I'm looking at the revenue estimate, revenue analysis, and they have got $48 million, but you're saying $4.8
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry if I misspoke. No, the repayment is $48 million and some $48,600,000.
So the interest on the highway bonds for 11 years was the $48 million, and that's what would be levied onto the Bloomington taxpayers.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Larson. Questions, members? Senator Mwah.
Senator Larson, I understand that the second phase of the Mall America is under contemplation, and I'm wondering, it sounds to me like you that there's a sense that Bloomington citizens didn't get much out of the first phase of the Mall America. How do Bloomington citizens think about this second phase that's being contemplated now?
Senator Larson.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Mwah, that's a great question that I wish I could quantify with a brief answer. I think the discussion, what's clear is that discussion is occurring. I think that what is clear in terms of how I would present how at least my constituents feel about it is that they knew that they were putting in an enormous investment. And you know, one of the things that I've had to fight since I got to the legislature 8 years ago, and as I learned more about the development of the Mall of America, was the sense that the state legislature and the state of Minnesota taxpayers built the Mall of America. And actually, quite frankly, it is the local taxpayers that bore the burden of the public subsidy. I think that Bloomington taxpayers would acknowledge that there stands to be a benefit to the city at some point. However, and that initial investment may well be worth the ultimate return. But you have to really look at how much subsidy has occurred to get us to this point, to realize how long it will take for us to recoup the investment. And this, of course, we've been happy that there's been a success. Bloomington taxpayers did not know that it would be a success. There was somewhat of a gamble or rolling of the dice, and had it not turned out as well, it would perhaps have been a far more difficult situation. But if you factor in that the original tax increment financing subsidy was $108 million, and that subsidy is still, so the property is not yet on the tax rolls. So the Mall of America isn't paying taxes yet on the improved part of the first phase. If you add to that the $48.8 million that's owed on the repayment, and then you factor in that in that original contract, there was a contract to also provide a tax subsidy on a second phase. And that is somewhere in the ballpark of $85 million that the city of Bloomington taxpayers are on the hook for as a second phase develops. And that's without even looking at the increase in the proposal that the mall has brought forward. Already we're at $241.8 million by my math of local contribution, almost $250 million in public subsidy to develop the Mall of America locally. Now, I will tell you that I think that Bloomington taxpayers believe that they've made an investment. They're hoping that it's been a good investment for the state and for them at some point, that they will at some point receive a benefit. But I think the feeling in Bloomington is we have sort of reached we've reached our limit. In fact, some of us believe we reached our limit before we got to the $241 million. But nonetheless, we're sort of at our limit. And that's a long answer to your question, Senator Moi, but I think that there comes a point by which the local taxpayers are wanting to say, you know, enough is enough in terms of the local investment. I think we can have a larger argument about whether the state should participate in and making the mall as successful as it can. One of the clear outcomes of a larger Mall of America is where we see the increase in revenues is in the sales tax revenue, in the area of sales tax. And that goes to the state general fund. And so to the degree that we can balance public contribution in terms of a state contribution to get a return on that sales tax, I think is a reasonable argument or discussion that we can have this session. But from the local taxpayers' perspective, we think we've got more than enough in the game now.
Mr. Chair, Senator, a follow-up question. Senator Larson, is am I hearing you say, though, that the city of Bloomington and the citizens of Bloomington feel like they just haven't gotten anything out of the Mall of America being in the city of Bloomington?
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bromois, no, I'm not saying that. In fact, I won't speak for the city of Bloomington. As you may experience from time to time, Senator Moi, I don't always agree with my city, as I imagine you don't always with yours. And I think they do a great job of running the city, and we agree on most things. This is an area we're having a little more trouble. And they have a proposal, and they've supported a proposal to supercharge that public investment an additional, I think, 50-some million dollars over what they're obligated to pay. And so we're having some trouble over that. And so the question isn't, does the city of Bloomington get benefit? I think clearly into the future, especially as the property comes online, the city stands to receive benefit. But right now, in terms of revenue streams, the city has received approximately $1 million a year from the facility.
And if you factor that against the $108 million TIF and the $48.8 million in repayment, it takes you a long time to receive back. And now that will accelerate when the TIF decertifies. But nonetheless, I think it takes taxpayers a long time to recoup that investment. And frankly, even the city has made its own argument. A year ago, the city brought a proposal that actually would have shouldered even more. And one of the arguments the mall and the city were making was the return that we thought would be there isn't as large as we had hoped. So therefore, let's just roll it all into the next phase. And the Bloomington delegation, as some of you maybe have served with Senator Belanger, remember that he didn't think that was a good idea either. And we sort of locked arms together on that. And we've been working together to try to find a way for everybody to agree. And again, that's a long answer to your question. But I think there's a difference of opinion within the city as to what the level of public commitment ought to be.
I think it's good that we have this context for the discussion with this repayment part. But I'm sure that the discussion of the Mall of America will be in the full committee later on this session. And so if we can target in on the 48 million, 5 million a year for 10-year property tax that this Bloomington City is asking to be relieved from. Senator Waugh.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sympathetic to Senator Larson's dilemma here, because I think whether it's Bloomington or Minneapolis or St. Paul or any other kind of regional centers, we do take on projects that have sort of regional or state significance. And depending on how the deals are negotiated, there are times when, in hindsight, you look back and you're trying to balance, what the burdens are. And given I hate to keep coming back to this, Mr. Chair, but, given sort of what's been happening at the local level with our cities' budgets, et cetera, some of this weighs pretty heavily on some of the cities. I think that when they negotiated some of these things, they probably didn't project or think that the burden would be so heavy at the local level. And I know that we have that with respect to the Xcel Energy Center in St. Paul, and I think Minneapolis faces that with respect to the Target Center, and I'm sympathetic to where the city of Bloomington is with respect to this loan, or to this loan in the Mall America. And I think it's hard. I mean, it's a very difficult dilemma to be in.
Can I add one thing, Mr. Chair?
Amazing how, when we look back at what our locally elected leaders have advocated for over the years. Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, I want to make sure that it's really clear for the record that I don't come to before you today with my rearview mirror and criticizing leaders either.
No.
judgments were made at the time. Governor Perpich was involved. It was a massive effort that tried to maximize development at that facility or at that piece, that those parcels of land. Bloomington, did receive, and I will fully admit, one of the things Bloomington received is they got put on the map. People all around the world know where Bloomington is if you tell them the Mall of America. I have people tell me that all the time, so there's a tangible thing there that has occurred. I think what we have the benefit of in being able to look back now is to say, how have we benefited as a state from the success of the mall, or locally, or in the fiscal disparities pool, in all the different factors of how we collect taxes, who's benefited and who's still on the hook. And we just want to try to fix some of those things as we're going forward. One of my issues probably with the second phase and that I've mentioned to my city leaders is those initial city leaders did put Bloomington on the map. You can't necessarily get put on the map a second time. So I don't know that intangible factor is there at this time.
Senator Ma?
I'm done.
Senator
Thanks.
Ortman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Larson, I can see that you're in a tough spot, and the city is in a tough spot on this, and I'm grateful for what happened with the city of Chanhassen before I was there. There was a state buyout of our TIF problem because we had put too much property into TIF, and we were upside down, and I'm appreciative of that. And you come forward and talk about the fact that the city is not generating a revenue stream on that property. But I would say that you also have to look at all those neighboring properties. I mean, you've got hotels that are going up that are being, you know, that big Grand Lodge that's next to it. I mean, you've got some properties along there that are generating big-time property tax revenue because of the presence of the Mall of America in your city. And I would say that that should be factored into your review of whether or not the project was a good one for purposes of the revenue stream. And then I would also say that there's a huge economic benefit for all those jobs in your community. If you want to pick up the Mall of America and move it to Carver County on Highway 212, we would be very grateful. So I think there are huge benefits to your community. And I think that, and I understand that you're acknowledging that and that you're looking at the costs and the benefits, both. And I appreciate that. I just wanted to comment that it's a fabulous facility. It's generating an awful lot of property tax revenues and neighboring properties, all kinds of job opportunities for kids after school, and also for managers and high-end jobs as well. So I think that should be considered when we look at this kind of a buyout.
Well,
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Ortman. I think there's no doubt that you certainly couldn't argue that there isn't an ancillary benefit, you know, as it relates to other properties. However, when the local folks are in for $250 million, you have to try to balance where is that. And there's not an endless amount of local contribution that can justify something that has been difficult for others to actually quantify of what that benefit is. And so there's no doubt the facility is successful. It attracts a lot of people, and perhaps there is some additional benefit. But nonetheless, the international airport is right there in that vicinity, and that's what drives a lot of the hotel rooms as well. You also have to factor against if that property had developed without public subsidy and had paid property taxes all of these years, where would we be as we look backwards? So there's a lot of questions you could ask and say, would the community have been further ahead without having the splashy development? I mean, just purely from a dollar-to-dollar perspective. Because I would say that, by and large, residents of Bloomington don't necessarily feel a daily impact given the location of the mall in terms of their daily life. I don't think most Bloomington residents are over at the mall every day. Most of them are not, and not receiving a facility benefit necessarily, other than that they may choose to shop there, you know, the same as other taxpayers in the metropolitan region. So I think those are a lot of good questions. But, you know, I think where Bloomington's coming, where I'm coming from on behalf of my constituents in Bloomington, we think we're at the max. In fact, we think we're over where we want to be in terms of local investment. But that's not to argue that we shouldn't move forward and find a way to maximize the success of the mall.
Is there anyone in the room that wants to testify or wants to testify on Senate File 811? Okay, seeing none, Senator Mwah.
Mr. Chair, just a technical question. When does the TIF district for the phase one of the Mall America go off or end? Do we know, Senator Larson?
Senator Larson. Mr. Chair, Senator Mwah, I'm going to hopefully get this right, 2015.
So, we're now 2000. So it's about 6-7 years away. How much money would the city of Bloomington capture once the TIF district ends in terms of property taxes?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Senator Mwah, to get you an accurate answer, I'll have to get you that. I have probably that information or that projection in my pile of information here, but I'd rather get you the accurate information.
And needless to say, Mr. Chair and Senator Larson, when the TIF district does end, the city of Bloomington and Bloomington residents would be very happy with the taxes that are going to get brought back into the city coffers.
Senator Larson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Mwah, they certainly will, because any time a property is actually paying property taxes, that's a good thing. And they took considerable risk and had the project failed. They would have suffered the consequences of that investment. They will, however, I would add, and I, you know, per capita, in fact, I need to get that number, what the
what the impact will be. Because just a year ago, the mall officials and the city of Bloomington were here arguing that per capita or per household, the impact would be so negligible that we'd be better to roll it into the second development. Mm. And so I don't have that number. I'll get you that number, though.
That would be helpful.
That's a number I should have in my pocket.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Larson, I think the committee would be interested in that. So. Without objection, we will lay Senate File 811 over for possible inclusion in the tax article. Thank you, Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble, let's start with Senate File 947.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. That makes sense. some volunteers here to testify on that, so that makes sense for us to go with that one. Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 947, I believe, is similar in concept to Senator Ortman's earlier bill, though I didn't take a look at the details, but I'm familiar with, you know, somewhat familiar with that bill as well. Simply put, Senate File 947 would seek to limit the amount of property tax that a household pays to 5% of that household's income for household incomes up to $77,520. It's, I'm sure I would probably echo Senator Ortman's presentation, though I did not eavesdrop on it, but I think it's an attempt to, of course, recognize that the property tax often has no relationship to a person's ability to pay and can get way beyond folks' ability to pay, in fact, creating, you know, significant hardship for individuals in the state of Minnesota. I will grant you that Senate File 947, it doesn't have the age triggers, and it's, somewhat more larger in scope and sweep than I think we have seen in the past. But it's an attempt to really put the issue in front of us that the property tax can be very difficult, can be a big burden for folks because, like I said, it only has a very loose relationship to household income in many cases. I can speak from my own experience as a representative of a district in Minneapolis, as well as one who worked for a city council member for a number of years at the city of Minneapolis, that many, many people living in their homes bought their homes many, many years ago, even in some of the you know, quote-unquote nice neighborhoods when property values weren't close to what they are now. You have folks living in those homes whose valuation has gotten beyond all bounds and reason. Folks are in, and the consequences is apparent, and I took those calls personally quite a few times. Folks not knowing what they're going to do. They could not keep up with everything they needed to keep up with. Their taxes, the maintenance of their property, and everything else that's pressing on their budget, particularly, of course, when folks have moved into retirement, though this bill doesn't recognize age necessarily because the circumstance is true for lots of folks. You know, my own personal experience, I bought my house 15 years ago for $80,000. It's now worth in excess of $300,000. So, you know, it's a modest little house in South Minneapolis. It's no palace. $300,000 would have been a palace when I first bought my house. But, you know, in a number of occasions, we had to figure out how to move people into different kinds of housing, you know, out of their houses, and they you know, were physically capable of living in their housing, you know, for a number of years. You know, those are the extreme cases. What you see more commonly are folks who are just quietly suffering significant budget burdens, not being able to, you know, take care of their own medicines and their own routine expenses of daily living. And what's more apparent as you drive through the neighborhood of the quote-unquote, you know, nice areas, the deferred maintenance, the kind of housing dilapidation that occurs because people just can't put the money into fixing the window frames and the roof and keep up with the yard and all those things. They're just keeping up with their property taxes. I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chair, and we have a few folks who are here to provide some testimony.
Well, thank you to bring this forward, Senator Dibble. I think as we wrestle with this session, this certainly is one of the larger issues that we're going to try to address. I think we should hear from the testifiers and then see if there's anybody from the department here also that would want to talk and have questions.
I'll let them introduce themselves in whatever order they want to go in.
Mr. Downing again.
Yes.
Mr. Downing?
Yes, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Mike Downing. Again, I reside in White Bear Lake, Minnesota. I've been a member of AARP for 10 years and member of the Minnesota Senior Federation, and I'm on the tax committee for the Minnesota Senior Federation. We would like to thank Senator Dibble and the other authors for bringing forward Senate File 947 as a practical and long-term solution to the property tax crisis that we have here in Minnesota. The Minnesota Senior Federation supports Senate File 947 since it is based on homeowners' ability to pay. It provides predictability for a homeowner in their planning for retirement and long-term budgeting. It establishes a limit to property taxes, very similar to the limit we have in income taxes of 7.85% is the maximum limit of a person's income that would be paid in income tax. Sales tax is 6.5%, gas tax of 20 cents a gallon. This provides for a cap of 5% of a person's income for property taxes. And it fits very easily within the confines of the existing property tax refund and targeting program. It just sits, it fits right into that kind of a program today. Senate File 947 represents the type of reform that voters and homeowners are asking for. Sometimes it's important to listen to stories. Senator Dibble talked about some stories. Each of you have had phone calls from your voters and constituents. Let me just tell you that the Minnesota Senior Federation, after the Truth in Taxation meetings last fall, and we had our notices, had a survey. And many of the people, members of Minnesota Senior Federation, sent back information from their Truth in Taxation forms. The results are quite startling. Even after the property tax rebate, even after the targeting programs, even after all the programs that we have in place today, some of our seniors are paying 6, 10, 15, 20% of their income on property taxes. We have individuals that are paying up to 29% of their income on property taxes. And the problem is that we have bought our homes 20, 30, 40, and sometimes 50 years ago, and it's the little appreciation year after year after year that puts us in a position of very high property taxes as a percent of our incomes. Janet Renz is a member of the Minnesota Senior Federation. She's 75 years old. She's a retired teacher and wrote a letter to this committee that I passed out in my testimony. She owned a home in Fridley. The property taxes in Fridley on that home got so large that she had to sell it. 10 years ago, she sold that house and moved into a townhouse. And again, that was 10 years ago. The property taxes on the townhouse are increasing to a point where she's going to be faced with the same decision 10 years later. How can she afford that house and pay the property taxes? Janet fully supports Senate File 947 and the 5% limit of income for property taxes for her to stay in her own home. We all have our own personal stories. Let me just share with you my personal story. My wife and I moved to the state of Minnesota in 1971 after graduating from college. We bought our first house in White Bear Lake in 1974. We were house poor like everyone back in those days. Yet, even though we were house poor, we only paid 2% of my income on property taxes in that house in White Bear Lake. 33 years later, we are paying 7% of my my pension in property taxes. Unless we do something, I will be in the same position as a lot of the other seniors 5 and 10 and 15 years from now, that I'll be paying 10, 15, and 20% of my income on property taxes. Senator Sieben asked the question, Senator Workman earlier, about number of years in the House. Now, I've lived in White Bear Lake School District for 33 years. I've just lived in three different houses. But we've only lived in our current house 9 years because we downsized after our children went to college. So I would not qualify under the 25-year. But I've lived in the same community, paid taxes in that same community of White Bear Lake School District for 33 years. As I indicated, I'm on a pension, fixed pension. I have had 0% increase in my pension over the 3 years I've been retired. This year alone, my property taxes went up 13.6%. I think you can understand that there's a period of time where I'm going to be forced into selling my house as well. Each of you have your own human stories, human interest stories. You've got the phone calls, you've got the letters. We need some reform by this committee and the tax committee and by the Senate. The American dream of work, getting an education, working hard, buying your house, paying it off, and living in that house in your retirement is fading away. Again, we need your help. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the Minnesota Senior Federation urges this committee to lay over Senate File 947 for inclusion in the division report, and we urge you to vote for the passage of Senate File 947 in the Senate. I stand ready for any questions you may have of me.
Thank you, Mr. Downing. And let's hear from the next gentleman first.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Don Weber. I'm from Shorewood, Minnesota. My wife and I are active at the Shorewood and Chanhassen Senior Centers, where we continue to hear the concerns of seniors regarding their property taxes. Because of our concerns and the concerns of the seniors in our area, we wrote a letter to our legislators, Senator Jen Olson and Representative John Burns, over 1 month ago, on February 2, 2007, to voice our thoughts. I'd now like to read that letter. Dear Senator Olson, my wife and I would like to ask for your help and support to reform our present Minnesota property tax system. We are 80 and 78 years old and purchased our home in 2001 for $153,000, and the estimated market value for 2007 is $235,000, which is an increase of 53.59%. However, our adjusted gross income has stayed constant with no increases, but our property taxes have gone up 40% in a 5-year period. The majority of homeowners have more or less a fixed income, so everyone is affected by the property tax system. Our property tax as a percentage of our adjusted gross income has gone from 5.88% in 2003 to 7.11% in 2007. Unless something is done, this will force many seniors out of their homes as they will be unable to pay their property taxes each year. And I'm sure you would not want to see this happen. We would like to see our property taxes set at 5% of the homeowner's income, which will then keep seniors in their homes. Thank you for your help and support, Don and Jerry Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Weber.
I'm Dan Michael, and I am here from Minnesota AFL-CIO State Retiree Council. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, by way of background, I'll just say that I'm President Emeritus of the Minnesota State AFL-CIO Retiree Council. We have 235 affiliates in the state of Minnesota representing all labor groups from teachers and roofers and auto workers, laborers, carpenters, electricians, and we all share common concerns. We estimate that there are probably 300,000 or more union retirees in Minnesota. And I also serve as president of the Minnesota Alliance for Retired Americans, which is a new group comprised of the State Retiree Council of AFL-CIO and the Senior Federation and the Minnesota Farmers Union. We're just in a startup phase in that group. But the problem before us is the one that you have heard described here this morning. Nationwide, 80% of retirees live in their own home. and skyrocketing property taxes are making that more and more difficult to do. I want to make 3 points of background information. Number one, the healthcare industry has changed in the last several years. And from my perspective, you know, the last 10 to 20 years. And we no longer have a stark choice between your own home and a nursing home. Or, as my grandmother would say, you know, it's no longer a choice between your own home and over the hill to the poor farm, which was a common expression at one time. Healthcare industry has visiting nurses. They have various types of calling systems to people's homes, Meals on Wheels. The list goes on. And the goal is to keep people in their homes. We want to keep people in their homes. And the increases in property taxes are driving people out of their homes. Second point I want to make, in December of 2005, I was a delegate to the White House Conference on Aging, and we discussed a number of issues. We went beyond Social Security and Medicare, which were, of course, top issues, but we looked at transportation issues, and we looked especially at housing issues. And it's not just Minnesota. Housing concerns for seniors is a very important issue that's being discussed and examined throughout the United States. My third point is similar to what you just heard from other people. I had a good friend of mine approach me recently and say, all my life I have supported public schools. I have voted for every school tax increase in the entire time I lived in my home. I believe in public schools. I want to educate the next generation. But with increased property taxes, it's getting hard. It's getting hard. And I have to seriously consider moving out of my suburban home and moving into full-time into a low tax area. Just a fact of life. So you've heard about the problem. The solution is before you. It's Senate File 947. And the Minnesota State Retiree Council, AFL-CIO, supports it and we urge you to act favorably upon it.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. And Senator Dibble, I think your bill does address some of the policy issues that we had talked about earlier. This doesn't bring about the differential between properties on the same street, as it addresses a percent of income. But questions, members? Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I'm trying to, and this is probably my own lack of clarity on these two areas. So, you know, if you can, you or your witnesses could help me, that would be helpful. I thought one of the tools that we had put in place to try to help perhaps our more fixed income and lower income homeowners was a circuit breaker. And so I'd like your witnesses, I'd like your thoughts on whether or not that actually is effective. And then I guess I'd like to also ask the follow-up on if you had this or the circuit breaker, which do you think would be more helpful, in particular for seniors or for people who are low income? Or are we contemplating it's this plus the circuit breaker would help address some of the needs?
Senator Moi, I think that this is kind of like a tiering of the circuit breaker. We'd leave the current circuit breaker PTR program in place, and this would be a level on top of it. But we can certainly have Senator Dibble or Mr. Donovan address that. Senator Dibble?
I think you're correct, Mr. Chair. This is, I think, in your handout. Did you get the handout? It's described by the Senior Federation as a super circuit breaker. This kind of supersizes the circuit breaker. This would clearly be more helpful because it also in places into statute for, you know, those household incomes at or below $77,000 a limit of, I mean, that's the core of the concept, that no one whose household is at that 77,000 level would pay more than 5% of their income in property taxes in any given year. And if that were to occur, then they would receive the refund, you know, in a greater amount, as described in the schedule on the bill.
What happens to the
Mr. Downing.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, last fall, I think it was October, we met with then Commissioner Dan Salamone and Paul Wilson on this matter, and we looked at the 5% based on an ability to pay by itself. But we saw the data that Paul Wilson had analyzed. He did the modeling, and he showed that the current system that you have in place today, the property tax rebate, the circuit breaker, and the targeting program, those things work very well to get together. So this bill keeps those in place, and then on top of it, it adds the 5%. So that it will control for those people that fall beyond that 5%, the general fund would pay that difference. Because right now we have people paying 7, 9, 10, 15, 20% even after the circuit breaker, even after the targeting 12% growth per year. So just think of this, I think Dan Salamone termed it as a super circuit breaker. Add those, keep the things that are in place today, and then add the 5% of income cap, and that's what this bill does.
And members, the other thing that we can keep in mind as we work to bring this all together, this would be scalable, you know, as we try to fit this into whatever targets we're going to have, because you could, you know, go to 5.5% or, you know, 6%. Of course, that reduces the impact to the property tax owner. Mr. Downing, you talked about the department. Is the department here, and would they care to discuss how this would work in their current PTR program? Is there administrative issues here?
Chair, I think someone was mouthing to me in the audience that the department is in the House right now. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Well,
so apparently we don't write this morning. Huh?
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, for some reason I don't have the fiscal note on it. I did see Senator Moss briefly. It was 55, and it proceeds to 75 million in the out years. I'm wondering what accounts for that increase each year, Senator Dibble, if you know.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman. I don't know.
Senator Dibble, Senator Dibble, Senator Ortman, I wonder if that wouldn't be the normal inflation of the property taxes, and unless you adjusted the percent, that would automatically go up because you would be providing the refund based on their income, but. I see that there was some information from Ms. Von Wash.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Well, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Von Wash.
Senator, I was just handing Senator Ortman my revenue estimate, and I was quickly reading through it to see if I could find the answer. And normally they would say on here what the increase was based on, and I don't see anything that says it specifically, so I would concur with what you said, that it probably is just the regular inflationary increases.
Thank you.
And there's the note, Senator.
Senator Ortman.
And Mr. Chair, one of the concerns about this bill, it's intellectually appealing to say that everybody would benefit from this, because there aren't a whole lot of Minnesotans that have flexible income. I mean, there are a lot of fixed income people, and some of us don't have a whole lot of control, and we can't just raise our per diems. That was meant as a joke, but because I voted for the per diems, just to be very clear on the record here, but shouldn't be smart this morning. But one of the concerns I have about this bill is it's essentially saying the state is going to do more to take over the property tax burden from Minnesotans, for Minnesotans. And we need to be really cognizant of the fact that now we are going to be responsible as the circuit breaker. And if we're going to, if
the numbers go up because of inflation and because of local spending and those kinds of things. Now the state is on the hook for this too, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying we should all be very aware of this is a very big overall policy change, and I'm a little uncomfortable with it, but I'm going to continue to learn more about it, and I appreciate the Senior Federation working so hard on this issue because we have a concern for all Minnesotans with these fixed incomes, not just, I mean, the disabled and everyone else. And in my bill, we're talking about the 65 years, and that doesn't necessarily address some of those folks as well. But I think this is a very broad approach, and I think we should proceed with caution, Mr. Chair.
I agree with you, Senator Ortman, as to whether we should put the resources into this second tier or perhaps put the same dollars into the first tier. We'll have to take a look and see what the effects of all that is. Is there anyone else that wants to speak on Senate File 947? Any more questions? Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to respond to Senator Ortman. She makes a good point. If the state is going to be, you know, on the hook for this kind of, you know, the kind of property tax escalations that we see. I mean, we are responsible, of course, in some of our policy decisions and fiscal decisions for some of the property tax increases that we've seen, but some were not. And the point that she makes about you know, decisions made at the local level would create a great fiscal. I mean, it's, you know, we have this discussion in one direction quite a bit, and this is just shining the light in a different direction, and we would definitely need to take that into consideration.
And Senator Dibble, I think the Senior Federation has done some runs on changing the threshold percentage a little bit, and perhaps as we go forward, I could work with you on taking a look at some of those again to see if there's a way to make this fit within what we're doing, and if the committee decides that this is the direction that we want to go. So, Senator Ortman.
I'll pass, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Downing, Mr. Weber, and Mr. Michael. Thank you, Senator Dibble. Without objections, we'll lay Senate File 947 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. And Senator Dibble, you have Senate File 633.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate File.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 633 has to do with energy efficient commercial properties, and what the goal of this bill is to create an incentive for in the commercial property sector, create an incentive for properties to be built to standards that are better than the current energy efficiency codes call for, and deliver better and more efficient, less energy consumption from those buildings. As committee members are probably aware, that calls for more expense. It's more expensive to build commercial properties or any property that's more energy efficient. And so this creates an incentive to do so by creating an index and a standard. If the energy consumption falls below 20 to 30% from what the code calls for, market value reduction of 5% would correspond. 31 to 50% market value reduction of 10% would be delivered, and then over 50%, a 15% reduction. This would be good for 10 years to recognize that it takes a while for the energy savings to catch up with the initial capital costs. And from that point on, of course, the savings has been realized by the owner of the property. And with that, that's kind of the 40,000 level. We have a couple of witnesses. We have Bob Ambrose from Great River Energy, and Doug Pierce from the American Institute of Architects. I don't know who would like to go first. Mr. Ambrose.
Mr. Ambrose.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm pleased to be here. My name is Bob Ambrose. I'm manager of governmental affairs for Great River Energy in Elk River, Minnesota. Great River Energy provides wholesale electric service to 28 electric distribution co-ops in Minnesota. Together, we and our members serve over 60% of the land area of Minnesota, a total of about 600,000 members, which translates to about 1.7 million people. Our mission is to provide our members with reliable energy at competitive rates in harmony with a sustainable environment. We've given considerable thought, especially in recent years, to how we can do our part in reducing the impact that we have on the environment. One way that we believe we can do that is to lead by example with our new headquarters, which is currently under construction in Maple Grove. When our headquarters is completed in 2008, we hope and expect that it will be one of only 16 new buildings in the world and the first in Minnesota to receive the U.S. Green Building Council's highest certification level, which is called LEED Platinum. LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. We are seeking this LEED certification as a way to measurably demonstrate our commitment to the environment and sustainability. Our plan is to showcase to our member co-ops and the larger community the energy efficiency measures that are employed in our new building. We will use the strategies and technologies that that our member co-ops and their customers can then apply to their own projects. Of course, as Senator Dibble indicated, it costs more up front to build a building like this to do the right thing, and that is why we're here to support a tax incentive to help encourage ourselves and other commercial building owners to move along this green path.
Thank you, Mr. Ambrose. Doesn't appear to be any other comments.
Starting to come.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this issue. My name is Douglas Pierce. I'm a practicing architect with the firm of Perkins & Will in Minneapolis. I'm here today representing the 2,100 members of the American Institute of Architects, Minnesota. We're a chapter of AIA National, which has over 78,000 members across the U.S., and I'm proud to say that AIA is celebrating its 150th anniversary this year, and National Architecture Week is coming up in April. Buildings, both commercial and residential, are responsible for approximately 48% of the carbon emissions or the greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. 18% of that comes from the manufacturing of materials, construction, long-term maintenance. 30% comes from the daily operation of buildings, basically the energy that's used to heat, cool, and light them. So buildings consume approximately 76% of the electricity that is generated in the U.S. AIA Minnesota and AIA National fully support significant reductions in the carbon emissions attributable to buildings. We are also... Sorry about that.
Everyone was thinking they needed new glasses.
I thought we were saving
there
energy.
There we go. That's better.
AIA Minnesota and AIA National fully support significant reductions in the carbon emissions attributable to buildings. We also support increased energy independence for our country. Energy-efficient buildings are an important part of the solution to achieving both of those things. To help illustrate the potential for saving energy in buildings, I have a few examples of energy-efficient buildings that are either constructed or under construction in Minnesota. This is an office retrofit.
Mr. Pierce, before you leave that slide, I have to ask. It says 48% of the carbon emissions are from buildings, and I've heard that 40 to 45% are from automobiles and tailpipes. What would be the other 12% or whatever it is?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's three basic areas of carbon emissions in the country. One is industry, one is transportation, the other one is buildings. Now, what we've done is we've calculated transportation emissions that are attributable to moving materials to construction sites, constructing buildings, some of those kinds of things. So the figures that you're looking at are probably a little different because of the way we've actually added it, looking at all of the emissions that are sort of attributable to buildings.
I've got it. You're counting. There's overlap there.
Right. There's overlap. This is an office retrofit that was done recently in South Minneapolis. It's part of the Midtown Exchange. This project runs about 42% better than code and will save approximately $5.9 million over 40 years. Now, quite honestly, this project is energy efficient because as the architect, I brought and was able to bring an incentive to the building owner and get their attention with that. The image on the upper left is the Wilder Center. This is currently under construction. We've projected this to be 45% better than code. The image on the lower left is Great River Energy's headquarters. We're expecting this to be about 60% better than code.
Mr. Chair, I think that's my daughter's class, actually.
I think that may be your daughter.
I think I just found her.
Well, we'll work through the Mr. Pierce, and let me say we have session at 11, so we begin to 7-8 minutes left.
Here. Okay, I'll move along swiftly. We're achieving these energy efficiency increases through higher efficiency mechanical systems, daylight harvesting, where we actually put the lighting systems on automatic dimmers and dim them down when the sun is up, computerized controls of lighting and computer and mechanical systems. There's a variety of things that we do. All of those things cost initial upfront capital costs for the building owner. Now, since 1994, energy efficiency in Minnesota, we have basically reduced the need for two power plants. A lot of that came through energy-efficient buildings. Now, many buildings are eligible for our SIP programs are not eligible for the SIP programs throughout the state of Minnesota. As a general rule, it costs about a third as much to save energy as it costs to produce it. So energy efficiency in buildings is both economically responsible and it's economically positive for the environment as a whole. I've personally been involved in energy efficiency planning for about 1 million square feet of buildings in the state, and our office has been involved in the planning for about 4 million square feet of new construction in the state. And what we've found out of all that construction is there are about 4 different attitudes about energy efficiency with owners. Many and most owners have a first cost attitude, and energy efficiency really is not on their radar at all. We bring it to them, and we can pique their interest with an incentive. Some owners are very willing to do a year or a year and a half simple payback on energy efficiency. Some will do 3 to 5 if they're going to own and operate it. So with an incentive, we can capture those people that are first cost driven and the energy efficiency just isn't on their radar, and we can also pick up the folks that have energy efficiency as part of their building programs and help them be more energy efficient. So basically, one of the things that would really help, and we believe this bill will help do that, is simply reduce the payback by 1 to 1.5 years. That means a lot to building owners. We need to raise the awareness of the issue with accountants, lenders, brokers, developers, the people that are making the first decisions on building budgets. And energy efficiency right now is not a major priority to business. Things like reducing healthcare costs, salaries, employee retention, those things capture the attention of CEOs and boards. An incentive will help bring this to boards, CEOs, et cetera. We do have a couple of suggested improvements to the bill. We think that the incentive ranges are just a little too coarse, and we'd like to see them be a little bit more incremental. And we would like to see an incentive for commissioning buildings potentially included as well. Commissioning is basically the same as tuning up your car and making sure the building is operating very efficiently. Overall, we think this is a very positive bill and are very much in support of the basic incremental adjustments and incentive levels. We think they will stretch owners to be more energy efficient, but they're very attainable. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. You talked about tuning up the car. If you're an owner of an older building that you'd like to have some modest improvements, but wouldn't probably be able to reach these percentages above the energy code. Is there some mechanism that you might suggest for assisting those folks in becoming conservation efficient also?
It's some form of an incentive would be helpful. Existing buildings are they're currently on the tax rolls. So a SIP program of some kind, a conservation incentive program, there are certainly things that can be done and retrofitted into buildings that are not extremely expensive. So incentive program could help.
Thank you. You have another testifier, Senator Dibble?
We have someone who has a creative and helpful suggestion.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Gary Grossinger. I represent Minnesota Association of Sefsing Officers. As Mr. May had stated earlier, the assessors agree in an ad valorem property tax system, and this would deviate from an ad valorem system, and we would therefore oppose this legislation. We think that basically it could be handled either through an income tax type credit or maybe a sales tax credit.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Grossing. We understand your concern with the market value reductions. Anything else? Any questions, members? Anyone else want to testify on Senate File 633? Well, Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. I don't have anything to add. You know, I'm sensitive,
thank
of course,
you for
to
bringing
anyone
this
who brings forward concerns.
Thank you for bringing this forward. And, you know, as we move toward renewable energies and all the discussion about energy use in the country and the state, I think that conservation and, you know, energy-efficient buildings is very important for us to be thinking about. And we'll take a good look at this as we're putting the bill together. Without objections, we'll move Senate File 633 be included in the property tax article. Thank you, members. Committee's adjourned. Oh, we're going to meet next Monday, I believe. We'll double check and get that to you. Committee's adjourned.